From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The vision is of small nuclear weapons, compact, specialized descendants of the powerful A-bomb that leveled Hiroshima in World War II, hypothetical warheads like the robust nuclear earth penetrator that proponents say could effectively take out an underground weapons cache or an underground enemy leader. Nuclear weapons that the U.S. might use surgically on or near a battlefield, unlike the stockpiled relics of the Cold War era. This month, a Senate committee voted to lift a 10-year ban on the development of small nuclear arms. A House committee voted to uphold the ban, but in a compromise, opened the door to new research on the banned weapons. Bush administration officials say that research isn't enough, that it's time to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons to address new threats. Are you ready for mini nukes, for nuclear shock and awe? Is this need real or imagined? And will small nukes make us and the world safer or ignite a new 21st century nuclear arms race? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is James Sterngold, national correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. He's been reporting on the small nuclear arms story since last fall. Good evening and welcome, James Sterngold.
My pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. James, this first caught our attention just last week when the House Armed Services Committee narrowly voted not to repeal this ban after the Senate Armed Services Committee already had. How hard is the Bush administration push to get this through? And despite the committee votes, might we still come out of this round of negotiations between the two branches of Congress, wings of Congress there, with an open field for small nukes?
Well, the Bush administration is pushing hard. It formally put the low-yield issue into the budget proposal for this year. Chances are that at the very least, there's going to be a significant improvement for the atmosphere for research. And the Senate, as you know, has been pushing for a repeal of the entire ban, so we could actually open the door. I do want to make sure that people understand that there's something of a misnomer in the expression mini nukes. I say that only because there is nothing mini about any kind of nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. These are vastly destructive weapons, which one can debate on the utility, but the idea has been spread that they're kind of pinpoint or weapons that can destroy just something very small, but that is certainly not the case.
They're powerful weapons, but the manner in which they would be deployed, I guess, is one thing that distinguishes them from the old "let's just demolish the city" World War II example. What can you be more specific, James Sterngold, about the utility, the special utility that the I guess the Pentagon has in mind for such weapons?
Well, the idea is twofold. One is specifically the idea is that you would use them to destroy underground bunkers that might contain weapons of mass destruction like chemical weapons or biological weapons. That's questionable. Many scientists say they would not work as designed. And secondly, the conventional weapons would do the job just as well or better. But the real reason for developing them is this. We currently have in our arsenal principally what are called strategic weapons. These are humongous bombs that are meant to destroy entire cities. And
these are the Cold War era bombs.
These are Cold War era weapons, and the concern is that they are so big and so destructive that a foe would never believe that we would really and truly use one, that they're just so awful that the United States would never actually do it. So that's referred to as a self-deterrent, that these are in our arsenal, but they're basically unusable. So they want to create a, quote, usable weapon. And the idea is if you create a low-yield nuclear weapon that would not destroy an entire city, but would in theory destroy something fairly small, that it's actually more usable and therefore a more effective deterrent.
And where does this stand on the Hill now? The House Armed Services Committee voted against repealing the ban, but what exactly did they approve?
Well, they're moving forward very rapidly. What the House did was come up with a compromise between Democrats and Republicans that would permit a far greater amount of research and design work to be done, but it would still stop the process when it came to actually producing these weapons. If they did want to do that, then they would have to go back to Congress and there would have to be a new vote.
Because it didn't come out of the committee with approval in the House, and that must have been a close vote given the membership of the House, could it still get to the floor of the House somehow and be voted through by the Republican majority there?
Conceivably. That's probably going to happen later this week on Thursday or so. But it seems likely that the compromise will be embraced. The House Republicans do tend to maintain discipline. The power structure in the Republican Party has, in the House anyway, has embraced this compromise. So it appears that the House is likely to embrace the compromise bill that opens the door to more research but still maintains the ban on production.
And the bill comes along with a $15 billion line item in the Defense Department budget. Is that enough to spur significant new research to really push this research forward?
Well, the initial design phase isn't really that expensive, and there's substantial money that would be available. There's several areas where they've provided money in the House and Senate versions of the bill to push forward design work on a variety of things. The bunker buster weapons would get $15 million. Something called advanced concepts would get $6 million. So at this stage, money is not an issue. It's really just about freeing them up legally to be able to do greater design work than they had been before.
And James, what's the talk in Washington? If these weapons had already been in the American arsenal at the outset of the war against Iraq, might one of them have been dropped on the famous first night target where Saddam Hussein was believed to have been?
Well, you ask a very interesting question because it gets at a fundamental point that's not well understood. We have these weapons already in our arsenal. The United States, over the course of the Cold War, developed a whole range of nuclear weapons, from humongous ones that can take out entire cities and kill millions of people, mm-hmm. to low-yield weapons. They're sitting on a shelf somewhere in a nuclear facility. So we already have certain kinds of low-yield weapons.
Now I'm confused again then. So what's the debate?
The debate is basically by people who want to have a stronger, quote, usable nuclear deterrent.
Doesn't the same question then still apply? If it were somehow a stronger, more updated, more finely researched version, might it have been used? Is that part of the program here or to take out Saddam Hussein?
Well, the Bush administration and the military have always been very cagey on this. What they have said is that they would not use any kind of nuclear device just as an anti-personnel weapon. What they have indicated was that they would only consider using nuclear weapons if we were attacked with some kind of weapon of mass destruction, or if we thought we could use it preemptively to take out an underground bunker that contained weapons of mass destruction that we thought were going to be used against us. So no, it does not seem that they would have used it as a purely anti-personnel bomb.
Weapon in that phase of that war. James Stringle, please stand by. I want to bring two other guests into the conversation. Joining me now from Washington is Charles Ferguson, physicist and nuclear weapons expert at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Good evening and welcome, Charles Ferguson.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Also joining us tonight is Frank Gaffney, president of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington-area think tank. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Force and Arms Control Policy in the Reagan administration. Good evening and welcome, Frank Gaffney.
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Frank Gaffney, can you elaborate on the perceived need for this research and for these weapons? Is it, do you agree with the characterization we've heard from James Stringle, that it's all about raising a more credible deterrent, or is this a real battlefield weapon that's being developed? What are the arguments? What are the strongest arguments for pushing forward here?
Well, I think some of them have been made, but one other that I think is particularly important is that we are facing, I believe, a crisis in our nuclear arsenal, and that is it is aging, it is obsolescing, it is going to become not only in terms of its design qualities, which are by and large very high yield, increasingly inappropriate to the kinds of missions for which it might serve, importantly, as a deterrent. In addition, the people that are necessary to maintain these exceedingly complex, sophisticated, and expensive weapon systems in a functional and safe condition can't be kept on in the absence of having useful work to do. They go do other things. There is, I believe, an infrastructure issue, a strategic or deterrent stockpile issue, in addition to some of the points that were made earlier by James in terms of the missions that are real and are likely to be increasingly important.
Frank Gaffney, do I hear you describing a kind of use-it-or-lose-it issue on the research front? Are you saying we need to, the United States must continue to employ nuclear weapons researchers in pushing this technology forward, or they won't be around? Is that it?
Well, what I'm concerned is not going to be around as a nuclear deterrent. I think we're approaching a point where we're losing, really in dramatic fashion, people who have any firsthand experience with how these things perform. The number of nuclear designers who are still on the job who've had firsthand experience with actual explosions of these devices is down to what you can count on one or two hands.
Frank Gaffney, is this a case?
That's an expertise that really is, it's not widely appreciated, but it really is essential to maintaining the stockpile. It's not use it or lose it in the sense of the weapons. It's a question of not being able to maintain these devices in a safe and, I think, effective condition that makes them, that's determinative, really, of how effective they are as a deterrent.
Got it. But given the profound ambivalence about nuclear weapons, is this a situation in which obsolescence should be welcomed rather than run from?
Well, there are some people who feel that ambivalence, and I think they ran the U.S. government for many years, which is precisely why we're in this state. We have had what the Senator at the House Armed Services Committee, rather, called some years ago erosion by design policy that was bequeathed to the Bush administration by the Clinton administration that really wanted, without ever admitting it, to disarm the country, to engage in denuclearization, as President Clinton once put it, but do it sort of through this rather innocuous and largely non-transparent fashion of just steadily taking down the infrastructure, both human and physical, that's necessary to maintain the stockpile.
Kind of obsolescence. Frank Gaffney, stand by. I want to welcome Charles Ferguson here. Charles Ferguson, do you see it the same way? We've got an obsolescing and inappropriate nuclear weapons stockpile that needs to be re-upped.
Well, Frank's argument is just unbelievable. We are now spending well over $6 billion a year on stockpile stewardship. This is more than we spent in the Cold War peak years in actual nuclear testing. So is Frank actually saying we should start conducting nuclear tests very soon? It almost is as if he's walking up to that line and wants to cross it.
Oh, I absolutely, I'm saying that. It would be far cheaper, and more importantly, it would be far more definitive as to whether the weapons that we have in the stockpile actually work. That's something we're speculating on. You're absolutely right. We're wasting billions of dollars trying to figure this out through devices and scientific methodologies that are not proven and that are, in the end, leaving us largely guessing as to the effectiveness of this deterrent. I don't think it's appropriate.
Charles Ferguson, it sounds like we're pulling back the covers on much more than just small nukes here.
Oh, indeed we are. There are a number of strands we need to pull on. We need to look at the international dimension here. The United States cannot act unilaterally. The Bush administration thinks that we can, but we are interconnected to all the nations in the world. The rest of the nations look to us as a world leader. So what kind of message are we broadcasting to the rest of the world when we say that if we believe Frank Gaffney, we need to start testing nuclear weapons?
Charles Ferguson, stand by. We're going to come back and look at this and more in detail, but I want to get one more word from James Turtgold. James, before we lose you, have we just heard the kind of parameters of debate that you heard on Capitol Hill in the last few weeks?
Somewhat, but I'd like to add just a small dose of reality.
Quickly, please.
It was mentioned by Mr. Gaffney that the Clinton administration introduced this frightening idea of denuclearization. This year happens to be the 50th anniversary of a speech given by President Eisenhower called Atoms for Peace. In it, he proposed, as his predecessor Truman did, that we consider eradicating all nuclear weapons and have a worldwide regime in force that would only use atomic power for peaceful purposes. That has been the American policy, which is also embedded in something called the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which was signed in 1968. That has been American policy all along, that these are terrible weapons, that we needed them at one time as a deterrent, and that we are committed to eventually eradicating them.
So I hear some waffling on that commitment tonight. James Turtgold, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
James Sterngold joined us from Los Angeles. He's national correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. We're talking about low-yield, small nukes, a new generation of nuclear weapons sought by the Bush administration, and the implications for security and proliferation. You can join the conversation. Does the United States need a new generation of powerful, small nuclear weapons? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about small nukes, low-yield nuclear weapons, a new generation of nuclear weapons sought by the Bush administration, and the implications of such weapons for security and for proliferation. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Can we have new nuclear bunker busters without busting nuclear non-proliferation? How many battlefield-ready, usable nukes do you want in the U.S. arsenal? And is this the threat of real shock and awe or a bridge too far? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Washington, Charles Ferguson, physicist and nuclear weapons expert at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He dealt with issues of nonproliferation as an official in the State Department from 2000 to 2002. And also from Washington, Frank Gaffney, president of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington think tank. Earlier, I spoke with Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who has been one of the most outspoken critics of lifting the ban on small nuclear arms. I asked her to describe her opposition to the development and testing of small nukes.
Well, I'm very strongly against it because I think for this nation, the strongest nation on earth, to venture into nuclear development at this stage in time will send a signal to every other nation that possibly can to do the same.
So why the push from the Bush administration for this new generation of weapons?
It's hard for me to tell, but the Nuclear Posture Review, which came out in the year 2002, that year was a big year. You had a new national security strategy. You had the doctrines of preemptory unilateralism, and you had a policy document called the Nuclear Posture Review, which essentially said a couple of things. One, it said that we would engage in a first use of nuclear weapons in certain circumstances. That's brand new to me. And it outlined a couple of scenarios, one of them being a North Korean attack on South Korea or a military confrontation over Taiwan. And then it addresses contingencies in which the United States might use nuclear weapons. And that's not in retaliation for a nuclear strike, but to destroy enemy stocks of chemical or biological weapons. And then it calls for the development of a new generation of nuclear warheads, including low-yield or so-called mini-nukes. Now, everybody has debunked this. I've asked the Secretary of Energy in hearings about it, and he says, oh, we have no plan. I asked Secretary Rumsfeld about it last Wednesday in a committee. He said, oh, it's just a study. But I don't believe it is. I believe what we're beginning to see is the wheels begin to move toward a new generation of nuclear activity. I think one of the things that's happening is that we are getting away from World War II when the United States used a nuclear bomb in Hiroshima. And I think, you know, young people don't really perhaps realize the devastation that this nuclear technology can bring about.
So what's the fundamental issue here in your mind, Senator Dianne Feinstein?
The fundamental issue for these mini nukes is to use them going after chemical or biological or underground weapons or underground manufacturing. We've got the most sophisticated of missile systems. It's hard for me to understand why the United States needs them. There's another thing that's inherent in this, and that is a blurring between the conventional and the nuclear. And we must not let that happen, because what the proponents will also say, oh, we're just adding something to a conventional design. And I think that is disingenuous. Once you start down the nuclear path again, you set into motion a number of things. For example, China. China has a no first use policy. It has about, from 18 to 24 ICBMs. We don't want China to start up testing. We don't want China going into the nuclear business. And yet, if the United States does, you can be sure that other countries will as well.
Senator Feinstein, do you think, looking out at the steps that have been taken in the Senate and the House of Representatives in committee, do you think that this Bush administration push can be stopped? Or when it comes to the full vote, is this going to go forward? Are we going to see the ban drop and mini nukes developed?
It's on the Senate floor right now. I and others will put forward an amendment tomorrow to repeal the repeal of what's called Spratt First.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 10-year-old existing law which provides that we will do no new research, study, planning in the nuclear area.
Can you win?
It's going to be very hard, but we're going to try, and hopefully the debate will make this a much more public issue, which it should be, because this is a major policy change.
Dianne Feinstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tom. Thank you.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein, she spoke with me earlier. You can join the conversation, listeners. Does Washington need fewer restraints on nuclear weapons development, or all the restraint it can muster? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Frank Gaffney, I want to ask you to respond to Dianne Feinstein here, the U.S. Senator. What do you make of her argument against this, that this is going to spark proliferation and that it's a dangerous evolution of U.S. policy on nukes?
Well, Tom, I really find it not terribly instructive. I think that there isn't a country on the planet at the moment that is not pursuing nuclear weapons programs that will do so if the United States upgrades and more importantly, modernizes its nuclear deterrent.
You're saying the race is already so hell-bent for leather that nothing the U.S. does one way or the other is going to affect it?
I'm just saying that the countries that we worry about acquiring nuclear weapons are acquiring nuclear weapons right now. And they're not doing it because we have them. They're doing it because in their own interests or perceived interests, they believe they can strengthen their position, oftentimes relative to some regional adversary, by having them. And I think what would be the height of folly in a world in which you do see countries, including some that are quite hostile to us, pursuing nuclear weapons, for us to persist in a policy, and whether we call it this or not, the practical effect of it is the steady erosion of our nuclear capabilities, leading ultimately to block obsolescence and denuclearization.
Charles Ferguson, I want to bring you in, Charles Ferguson. Give us your context on this, because it does seem as though everybody's saying we're sliding into a kind of new relationship with nuclear weapons, and I hear some voices tonight welcoming it and others opposing it. Have we willy-nilly crossed some kind of boundary into a new era where there's no choice? What happened to resistance to proliferation?
Well, let me see if I can try to kind of split the differences here. I mean, I think Frank Gaffney is partially correct in the sense that nations, by and large, if they want to develop nuclear weapons, they don't develop nuclear weapons mainly because the United States has nuclear weapons. They develop nuclear weapons mainly in a regional security context. And we see this to happen in pairs, India versus Pakistan, mm-hmm. for instance. Or sometimes they'll develop weapons in a nationalist context. And we've also seen that with India. That's why they decided to test in May 1998. A new party had entered power, a very conservative party. They're a very nationalist party. But that spurred Pakistan to follow in suit. So Frank is correct in the sense that what the United States doesn't have as big an effect as what happens in a regional context.
Does that mean, Charles, instead of setting the pace, the United States is now playing catch-up?
No, not at all. The United States is at a position of strength, and I find it laughable that Frank keeps going on about block obsolescence and denuclearization when the United States is so far ahead of everyone else in the nuclear realm and with conventional military force. I mean, he's describing us as if we're ready to have a regime collapse here in the United States, whereas other nations, if they want to their regimes to survive, like North Korea, they might feel the need to turn to nuclear weapons to give their regime another prop to allow them to survive.
And what about
Can I respond to that, please, Tom?
All right, Frank Gaffney.
Look, I think that what I'm talking about is not that hard for people to comprehend if they have the least bit familiarity with the actual technologies here, but very few people do. I'm talking about designs of arguably the most sophisticated pieces of equipment ever made by man, many of which were put into place 20 or more years ago, which have highly radioactive cores, which in turn, by proximity to other complex pieces of equipment, over time materially degrade, in fact even change the quality of those other components. And many of those components are no longer possible to produce. They are made of materials that are toxic, that are impermissible under our current environmental regulations. So you have a set of circumstances and systems that are simply aging out from under us, and this idea that they can just sit on a shelf and be kept there indefinitely, or that we can just do a lot of experiments on them and maybe even just sort of change piece parts here and there and everything will work the way it was supposed to, is just not, I think, realistic and not actually the case.
Frank Gaffney, we've got your point there, but I'm looking for another vantage on it. Charles Ferguson, maybe you can provide this. A, do you agree? Do we have a kind of deterioration of the old nuclear weapon stock? B, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And if it has to be addressed, how does this debate about small nukes or low-yield nukes figure in here? Is what I hear being suggested it's time to kind of revamp the entire U.S. nuclear arsenal? And is there a counter voice that says, let's let it go and let bring the rest of the world on a denuclearization path with us?
Well, you've outlined a number of potential pathways, but I mean, this is just ridiculous because, you know, another thing that's been going on in parallel to the exploration of possible new nuclear weapons is the revamping of the plutonium pip production, the nuclear trigger for our nuclear weapons. That's been revamped at Los Alamos. And so we're taking steps to making sure that we can remanufacture the nuclear components of our nuclear weapons. As I indicated earlier, we're spending well over $6 billion a year testing all the non-nuclear parts of our weapons. We're conducting subcritical nuclear tests at the Nevada test site. Those are tests that lead up to a nuclear chain reaction but do not cross that line. We're the nation in the world that can afford to do this. No other nation, not even Russia, can really afford to do the kind of testing we're able to do. So, yeah, by definition, radioactive materials will decay. We all know that. But, you know, this sense that they're so highly radioactive that these things are going to fall apart, you know, a year after they're made, it's ridiculous. You know, plutonium has a very, very long half-life of 24,000 years. Uranium
I think you're missing my point, Charles.
I think we've got both your points in a way. I want to invite our callers in, if you'll please stand by. Frank Gaffney and Charles Ferguson, stand by. I want to invite in Terry from Nahant, Massachusetts. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm still sitting here in disbelief at what I'm hearing. Who the heck are these weapons proposed to be used against? I mean, what can a nuclear attack do that we haven't already done with conventional arms to the Iraqis in a month?
You mean, what would it add, and who would they be aimed at?
Yeah, I mean, unless we think that we're going to be invaded from Alpha Centauri or something else, I don't see anybody who is A, going to get anything out of attacking us other than obliteration, and B, that we would have to worry about using a nuclear weapon on, because we could probably do it with conventional.
And Terry, what about the argument that we heard earlier that potential opponents don't believe that the United States would use its fat old nuclear weapons because they're just too terribly destructive, and so there's no deterrence there? Can you see that dynamic, Terry?
Well, if I believed that there was a threat out there that needed nuclear weapons of any kind for deterrence, we have just proved that we could cream another country using conventional weapons in, what, less than a month?
It didn't take long, Terry. Thanks for your call. Charles Ferguson, let me put that question to you.
Well, to answer Terry's question, if we look at the nuclear posture review that was released beginning of last year by the administration, seven countries are explicitly named. Among those are the usual suspects, the so-called axis of evil states, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, but in addition, Syria, Libya, and, surprise, surprise, China. So, you know, the cat's out of the bag here. It's not just states that are on our current enemies list or state sponsors of terrorism list, but also China is a potential target of new nuclear weapons or the good old nuclear weapons we already have.
But how does a lower yield weapon come into play? Do you agree that there is no effective? Would you please stand by one moment, Frank Gaffney? I'll turn right to you. But I want to ask you, Charles, we heard from Frank on this that he doesn't believe the deterrent remains. People don't think that the United States would use these big weapons. Charles Ferguson, what's your view? Do low yield weapons make a more effective deterrent and therefore, in the old logic of the Cold War, kind of diminish the chance of a nuclear exchange?
Well, I can think of a couple of uses of nuclear weapons I'm willing to consider. Yes, I do see some potential merit to the argument that if you want a fully flexible nuclear deterrent, you may need very low-yield nuclear weapons because the argument is that these nascent nuclear weapon states like North Korea would only have low-yield nuclear weapons. So if North Korea breaks deterrence by launching a nuclear weapon at us or our allies, then it would be more credible to use a proportioned response, a low-yield nuclear weapon in response. And so if North Korea feels that we have that in our pocket, so to speak, then the feeling is they might be deterred from using their weapons in the first place.
And are you arguing with this logic? Are you arguing with this logic?
No, I'm saying there might be some merit to that. But and so, yes, I'm saying, right, I see that the argument, and I see that, right, there's something to it. But on the other hand, go back to what Senator Feinstein was saying. We have to ask what kind of message you're broadcasting to the rest of the world. We've made a commitment under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to eventually pursue nuclear disarmament. We haven't made a time-bound commitment to do so. Mm. But, you know, getting back to Sterngold's argument about atoms for peace and the trade-offs. The deal we made with the non-nuclear states is, look, if you sign a non-proliferation treaty and agree not to develop nuclear weapons, in exchange, we'll provide you with peaceful nuclear power and we will pursue nuclear disarmament. Mm. And so developing these low-yield nuclear weapons for whatever purpose goes against the trend of supporting the non-proliferation treaty, which has been a pretty successful treaty.
Frank Gaffney, we just got 30 seconds before the break, but do you see if we move forward on this path, if the U.S. moves forward, does it throw non-proliferation out the window?
Well, I hope you'll give me time after the break.
Yes, I will.
On
that point.
The bottom line is the one I gave you before. Non-proliferation has not worked. You have countries that are now pursuing nuclear weapons despite treaty obligations not to do it. We did not commit to get rid of ours by a time certain, and under present circumstances, I think it would be the height of irresponsibility to do so.
Let's leave it there for the moment. We'll be back after a short break. We're talking about small, low-yield nukes, a new generation of nuclear weapons sought by the Bush administration, and the implications for security and proliferation. Should use of a small nuclear weapon be as taboo as use of a big one? Or should the U.S. military have more flexibility to decide? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about small nukes, a new generation of nuclear weapons sought by the Bush administration, and the implications for security and proliferation. You can join the conversation. Can we have new nuclear bunker busters without busting nuclear non-proliferation? And does developing new nukes signal U.S. strength or signal an international nuclear free-for-all? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are we in that free-for-all? Already, my guests tonight are Charles Ferguson and Frank Gaffney. We're joined right now by Mark from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
I would like to remark that Lenin said, treaties are like pie crusts. They are meant to be broken. And for America to put her faith in scraps of paper with, for instance, the Russians, who have broken every arms proliferation treaty that they have ever signed, is sheer lunacy.
Mark, may I ask, does that mean that in your view, nukes are a one-way street? There's no treaty that will ever pull the world back, and we might as well, you know, jump on the development bandwagon and ride it wherever it goes?
There's no turning back. because unlike our country, there are plenty of countries in the world like China, North Korea, and possibly Russia who might very well use these weapons. And the only strength and the only protection that we're going to have is by having a strong nuclear posture so that our enemies are deterred from striking us.
Mark, we got it. Frank Gaffney, are you suggesting that the aspiration of nonproliferation is a dead letter? It's over.
No, I think we're going to have to pursue it through different means. That's all. I think that what the president has been enunciating and acting on is very, very much the wave of the future.
But I don't see the path toward the...
Excuse me just a second. Yeah. Tom, may I please finish at least one thought? He's talking about regime change as a means of effecting nonproliferation or ending proliferation where it's taking place. That is a breakthrough that I think has the prospect for really transforming the kind of world that we've been otherwise condemned to by phony treaties in which lots of people enter into agreements, as was just mentioned by the caller, with no intention of adhering to them, and all the while building up the means to affect adversely our interests or threaten our friends and our forces overseas.
Let me ask on that. Are you suggesting then that this is part and parcel of a kind of unilateralist foreign policy that doesn't forget the old kind of international bodies legislating? It's about power projection, and a new generation of nukes will give the U.S. more leverage to forcibly drive nuclear weapons out of other countries. Is that the suggestion, Frank Gaffney?
Well, as one of your callers just indicated, we did regime change in Iraq without using nuclear weapons. I don't think anybody, and certainly not the Bush administration, wants to use nuclear weapons. The idea is to have credible nuclear weapons to deter their use against us, and under extreme circumstances where only they can be used to prevent vastly greater danger being posed to us, to use them in a manner that is minimally damaging to unintended populations and others. That's why getting smaller, precise, and, for example, deep penetrating weapons is desirable. But I just want to emphasize this point. We're not interested in doing this unilaterally if it can be avoided. The beauty of, I think, in the end, going forward with the liberation of Iraq was we had lots of company once the president determined that that was what we had to do.
Well, there's another subject, I want to stick on nukes. But Charles Ferguson, I feel like a guy waking up and suddenly the world looks very different. Am I hearing this evening that the era of commitment to nonproliferation is past? It's over. It's a jungle out there, and the U.S. has to dive in armed to the teeth with a new generation of weapons to maintain any clout and credibility. And maybe the only way to nonproliferation is to forcibly disarm countries one by one.
Oh, not by any means, Tom. There have been a lot of success stories with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Let's get it straight. A Non-Proliferation Treaty is not perfect. No treaty is perfect. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. What I mean by success stories are the following. Countries like Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, and Belarus, all those countries decided to give up their nuclear weapons at one stage or another, and to denuclearize and joined a non-proliferation treaty as non-nuclear states.
But speak to the tougher nuts that Frank Gaffney raises, the ones less likely to voluntarily step forward. Is Washington in the Bush administration giving up on the kind of pull, it's push instead in terms of getting rid of nuclear weapons?
Well, you know, Ukraine was a tough nut, but that's another story. But let's go back to North Korea and Iran. We've already dealt with Iraq. We've more or less effected regime change there. And see, what I'm concerned about is this cowboy mentality that we call the shots. We're the ones to determine what nations deserve regime change. You know, President Bush made a show of working with the UN, but when push came to shove, what happened? When he had serious resistance from our longtime allies, he decided we're going to go it alone and didn't give the inspectors enough time. And what are we seeing in Iraq? We're not really seeing any weapons of mass destruction. Sure, some may show up down the road, But in evidence long before we invaded Iraq was that the evidence the Bush administration had that Iraq was developing nuclear weapons, that evidence was more or less fabricated.
I hear you both stretching out to the bigger foreign policy picture, and it certainly is part of the conversation tonight. We have a lot of callers who want to go straight to the point. Mark is calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
It becomes clearer every day that the Bush administration, from the White House on down, is run by a bunch of madmen with an insatiable lust for power who will stop at absolutely nothing to gain and consolidate that power. And I am afraid that the American people are going to see very quickly the bitter fruit of the seeds that they've sown in electing a neoconservative Republican majority to Congress.
Mark, how do you hear that in the conversation this evening?
Well, I'm hearing Mr. Gaffney poo-pooing the dangers involved in this. I mean, those of us who are old enough to remember and have had a good enough education to know something about what happened in the early part of the 20th century know and recognize that the rhetoric coming out of the Bush administration is pretty much the same rhetoric that was coming out of the Third Reich and Nazi Germany
in the
1930s.
Oh,
and to prove my point here is a quote.
Look,
naturally, the common people don't want war. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifist for lack of patriotism. That came from Hermann Göring, and I'm hearing that kind of rhetoric coming out of the Bush administration and the neoconservative Republicans day after day.
Well, let's hope not. But Mark, thank you for your call. Frank Gaffney?
Look, I, first of all, you've mischaracterized my view, and certainly your caller has. I'm not saying that this is not a danger. I'm, to the contrary, making the point that the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, not only nuclear but these other sorts, is very much a danger. I'm simply pointing out, and it may be news to you, Tom, but I hope it's not news to most of your listeners, that we've seen in a systematic way countries, many of them signatories of these treaties, some not, simply pressing ahead covertly, illegally, with the weapons of mass destruction programs that are aimed at us and at our friends and allies and interests around the world. I'm trying to talk in a world in which we have been attacked. President Bush wasn't making it up. I'm concerned that perhaps he was not paying as much attention to the prospect of attack as he should have been before September 11th, but he certainly has been pointing to the reality of attacks subsequent to it. He's not making this up, and to compare what he's trying to do to defend us to Hermann Göring and Adolf Hitler is just, I think, way over the top.
We've got it. Charles Ferguson, last word goes to you. We've just got 20 seconds left here.
Okay, let's just get back to mini nuclear weapons. I want to throw out the idea that there could be a hidden agenda here. Low-yield nuclear weapons for bunker busters are not going to work for a number of reasons. I think what they might be used for is for missile defense. We know the administration has vowed to deploy missile defense system by the 2004 presidential elections, and nuclear-armed interceptors might be what they're vying for.
We'll have to end it with that final thought. Charles Ferguson, thank you for joining us tonight. And Frank Gaffney, thank you to you.
Thank you.
Frank Gaffney is president of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington think tank. Charles Ferguson is with the Monterey Institute of International Studies. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, weapons inspector Mohammed El-Baradei on his dream for the future of the world. This is On Point. One of the United Nations' chief weapons inspectors, Mohammed El-Baradei, is warning of a budding nuclear emergency in Iraq. El-Baradei worries that the looting of nuclear sites in Iraq is causing radioactive contamination. And today he called for the immediate return of UN weapons inspectors to ease the problem. Yesterday, El-Baradei was keynote speaker at commencement for the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. In his address, El-Baradei stressed that the interests of all nations of the world are now interconnected. Quote, your choices, your actions, and even your inaction will have consequences not only for you, but for your fellow human beings across the globe, El-Baradei told the class of 2003. Here are excerpts from his address.
In this third millennium, the world is globalized and interdependent as never before.
We live on a planet characterized by what some chaos theorists have called the butterfly effect, a natural world so interactive and interdependent that a storm in New England may be created as a result of butterflies flapping their wings as far away as China. At times, I have experienced this phenomenon firsthand, because a remark I would make to a reporter in Tehran only hours later could be misquoted on a European television station and create a diplomatic row in Washington. But more seriously, this interdependence has become the key feature of our modern world. Global warming, internet communication, the global marketplace, the war on terrorism, even the outbreak of SARS, all point to the fact that the human race has walked through a door that cannot be re-entered. Yet, with all the strides we have made to connect on so many levels, we continue to be disconnected on many others. We think globally in terms of trade, but we continue to think locally in terms of violent conflict. We cherish our connectivity on the web, but our solidarity is less visible in matters of extreme poverty and repression. This is a mindset we need to change, and the sooner we make the transition in recognition that human security is global and interdependent, the sooner we'll achieve our goal of a planet with peace and justice as its hallmark. More than a decade ago, the birth of a much vaunted New World Order was heralded on the heels of the Cold War. Yet, such a new order, unfortunately, has not yet taken shape. Instead of the superpower rivalries of the Cold War, new dangers and challenges have risen to the fore. And in this new landscape, nuclear weapons have continued to have a position of prominence as the currency of ultimate power. Several thousands of nuclear weapons continue to exist, and more countries, at least 8 or 9 by the last count, are in possession of nuclear weapons. Must we conclude then that the preemptive use of force to smother perceived threats to security is the new norm and model to pursue? Must we conclude that it is futile to rely on a collective rule-based system of peace and security? I certainly hope not. But reliance on a system of collective security will require bold thinking, and it will require states and societies to see, think, and act multilaterally. None of us, as mortals, hold a monopoly on the ultimate truth. And yet, all of us should continue to seek it, each on his or her own way. This is a tall order, but if our aim is to spare future generations the prospects of conflicts and wars in which humanity could self-destruct, we have no other alternative. Let me remind you once again of the phenomenon I described at the outset, the phenomenon of the butterfly effect. Your choices, your actions, and even your inaction will have consequences not only for you, but also for your fellow human beings across the globe. I call upon all of you to travel, to meet different people, to expose yourself to different cultures. Only then will you validate the main lesson of my own life experience, that there is only one human race, a race to which we all belong.
Mohamed El-Baradei, head of the UN International Atomic Energy Agency, delivering the commencement speech yesterday at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in Medford, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funding.